The top stories: Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says it flew a drone over Israel for 40 minutes and returned it untouched. The U.S. president has again upped the ante with Russia, claiming that Moscow is moving towards an imminent invasion on Ukraine. And Iran urges Western parties in the Vienna talks to show real flexibility and offer initiatives to achieve a good agreement as soon as possible. Let's just begin with our top story. Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah says it has successfully flown a reconnaissance drone over Israel. Hezbollah says the mission lasted 40 minutes and the aircraft returned untouched. Despite attempts by the Israeli side to down it, the Israeli military said its air defense system fired at the drone, but it went off the radar before being intercepted. Reports say Israeli warplanes later flew over the Lebanese capital, where a loud sound was heard. Earlier, we got in touch with Mariam Saleh, our correspondent in Beirut. She gave us the context of Hezbollah's mission and what it means.
This is a very significant incident. It's not the first time that Hezbollah was able to fly a drone over, of course, what they consider is occupied Palestine, but they are monitoring the Israelis. And of course, this is specifically is very significant because the Israelis almost had no clue what was happening. One of the most important things is that the Israelis are launching right now maneuvers. They were actually taking place at this, coinciding at the same time as the drone flew over. And Hezbollah seemed to be sending a message to the Israelis that we know and they have intelligence what maneuvers are being held. The maneuvers are basically a drill to see how the Israelis can deal with a possible Hezbollah, as they call, invasion of the Galilee. And so if Hezbollah decides to go and attack the Israelis within the territory of Palestinian northern Palestine, that itself is considered a very big concern for the Israelis. And this is why they're conducting these drills. And therefore, Hezbollah decided to fly those drones. And it's still not accurate whether it's one or two, but they flew the drones over the maneuvers, and they were able to monitor them. They were able to get intelligence. They were probably able to take footage of what was happening, and then that returned. The drone returned safely to its destination, and this in itself is considered very significant. The Israelis had to use F-16 fighter jets in order to try to target those drones, and still they could not, and they lost track of them finally, and just guessed that probably they went back. And Hezbollah, of course, stressed that this was done, and this was the case, that Hezbollah was able to fly that drone. So what we have here is basically a tit-for-tat strategy for Hezbollah. It's no longer just waiting for the Israelis to come bringing their drones to the Lebanese airspace and Hezbollah trying to defend or deter them. It's also Hezbollah actually flying those planes over Israeli targets and military targets and military drones.
Political commentator Jamal Wakim says sending the drone to fly over Israel and getting it back safely sends a message to the Israeli regime that Hezbollah is fully ready for any military confrontation.
This incident comes 2 days after the speech of Sayyid Nasrallah in commemoration of the 14th anniversary of martyrdom of Imad Magnihi, who was the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the resistance, and in which he said that the strength of the resistance is increased, and that the resistance not only has the know-how of how to produce these drones, but they are actually producing them. So sending one reconnaissance drone in a challenge to the Israelis is a message from Sayyid Nasrallah that we are serious about what we are saying. And the fact that the Hezbollah were able to send the drone and get it back safe and sound makes this is evidence that they are in full control of the drones and they can, in case there is a confrontation, a military confrontation, they can send hundreds and thousands of drones and get them back, and this would be harmful to the security of the Zionist entity.
The U.S. president ramps up his rhetoric against Russia amid mounting tensions in Eastern Europe. Joe Biden once again claims that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is imminent.
But the fact remains, Russian troops currently have Ukraine surrounded from Belarus along the Russian border and with Ukraine to the Black Sea in the south and all of its border. You know, look, we have reason to believe the Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week, in the coming days. We believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people. We're calling
out Russia's plans. Biden said he is convinced that his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, has already made up his mind on invading Ukraine. The U.S. president warned that war will close the window for diplomacy with Moscow. Biden also said Western countries will not deploy troops in Ukraine, but will continue to bolster its defensive capabilities. Earlier, the White House said Washington and its allies are working on a sanctions package in case of a Russian invasion. This is while Italy says the bans should not target energy imports from Russia. Two explosions rocked the city of Luhansk in eastern Ukraine as tensions escalate between government troops and pro-Russian forces. Russian media said one of the blasts hit a gas pipeline near Luhansk. A second explosion struck the city 40 minutes later. There are no reports of casualties. Meanwhile, France and Germany urged Russia to use its influence on pro-Russian groups for de-escalation in eastern Ukraine. This comes as pro-Russian forces and the Ukrainian military shelled each other's positions. Each side accuses the other of violating a 2015 ceasefire. Russia has expressed concern over the renewed clashes, describing the situation as potentially very dangerous. The leader of pro-Russian forces has announced the evacuation of civilians in Donetsk and Luhansk areas. Iran calls on the Western signatories to the 2015 deal to show real flexibility and offer initiatives in the ongoing talks aimed at reviving the accord. The Iranian foreign minister says the Western side's approach towards Tehran's initiatives determines whether the talks will yield results in the coming days or weeks. Hossein Amir Abdullahian has expressed hope that the parties involved in the negotiations will reach a good agreement in the near future. He made the remarks before attending the Munich Security Conference in Germany. This comes as Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are engaged in intensive negotiations in Vienna to restore the agreement, which has been left in a limbo following the U.S. withdrawal in 2018. Iran insists that the revival of the deal hinges on political decisions by the U.S. and the Europeans, as well as a verifiable removal of sanctions. Our correspondent in Vienna, Homa Lesgi, joined us earlier with an update on the ongoing talks in Vienna between Iran and the P4+1 group of countries.
This morning, there was a meeting between the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Ali Bagherikani, and the EU coordinator, Enrica Mora. And we just also heard last night from Russian Ambassador Mikhail Oryanov that he believes the sides still need time in order to be able to resolve the outstanding issues. And Mr. Oryanov has also recently tweeted saying that as we get closer to a final agreement and the final stages of the negotiations, in his words, opponents are becoming more proactive and are trying to create an unhealthy atmosphere in the public space as these talks are reaching the last or final stage. And this could be a reference to certain reports that have been circulating in the media about, for instance, the context of a possible agreement, the contents and what the draft would entail, etc. And those reports, of course, have been rejected or dismissed by Iranian officials and sources. And as we know, one of the advisors to the Iranian negotiating team, Professor Mohammad Marandi, has also said that those reports are not credible. And when talks conclude, and if that happens, we will see the deeply flawed nature of these reports. And he's also said that some Europeans are hampering progress by introducing demands that go beyond Iran's JCPOA commitments. So this is also what we've been hearing from other sources close to the Iranian negotiating team. They've been also suggesting that some of the sides, presumably the Europeans, are putting forward last-minute demands or making requests that go beyond the framework and the commitments that have been outlined in the 2015 agreement known as the JCPOA.
A senior Iranian official has warned Europe that its support for the terrorist Mojahedin-e Khalq organization will come at a price, just as it did with Daesh. Kazem Gharibabadi says it's disgraceful that European lawmakers are turning a blind eye to MKO crimes for their own political interests. Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights says Europe and the United States have committed the biggest crime against the Iranian nation through support for terrorist groups as well as illegal sanctions. Gharibabadi stressed that European countries must be accountable for their human rights violations and are in no position to preach others in this regard. About 12,000 Iranians have fallen victim to the MKO's act of terror over the past four decades. The terrorist group is currently based in Albania, where it enjoys freedom of activity after being delisted by the EU and US in 2009 and 2012, respectively.
The MKO terrorist group appears to be expanding its operations to include trafficking, among other criminal activities. An Albanian historian and journalist says the country's police have alerted the US embassy that members of the terrorist organization are involved in various criminal activities in Europe, including human trafficking, with possible links to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. Alsi Jazeshi, citing Albanian media reports, says the MKO operatives, headed by the terrorist ringleader Mariam Rajavi and based in a camp near the capital Tirana, have attempted to traffic over 400 of the group's own members to France. Jazeshi added that a number of the terrorist cult's members have been detained for trafficking people from the Middle East to Europe, who were most likely Daesh terrorists. The journalist also says some senior MKO members, including the ringleader's sister-in-law, have been arrested while trying to traffic drugs into Italy, with police having prosecuted another member over theft charges. The Albanian police deny sending any letter to the American embassy without elaborating further. The journalist says the terror group has forced an Albanian media outlet to take down an article it published about the arrests.
They used Albania as a safe haven to carry out illegal activities and criminal acts. And now they are becoming a problem for Greece, Italy, Germany, and France. And when I say problem, not just trafficking human beings, drugs, money laundering, and some other activities. They have become a problem for Albania for the crimes I just mentioned, but also burglary, pickpocketing, harassing women, sexual harassment, and at least one case of rape.
Critics in Albania blame the United States and its Western allies for providing protection for the terrorist cult.
Well, since the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, almost 17,000 Iranians have lost their lives in terror attacks there. Nearly 12,000 have been killed in attacks by the MKO alone. The terrorist group is also notorious for its extremely suppressive control over members in its camps. Despite that, the U.S. has continued to support the group, which expanded its anti-Iran operations under former President Donald Trump.
Mujahideen Khalq Organization, MKO, also known as the MEK, is a notorious anti-Iran terror group that embraces an ideology that mixes Marxism and terrorism. MKO's crimes against Iran run the gamut from collaborating with Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 war on Iran to a violent campaign of bombings across the country. One of the group's highest profile acts of terror came on June 28, 1981, when a powerful bomb went off at the headquarters of an Iranian political party, the Islamic Republican Party, where the party's leaders were holding a meeting. The bombing killed scores of Iranian officials, including the then head of Supreme Judicial Council, Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti. Most recently, Iran said there were traces of MKO involvement in the assassination of Iran's top scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh in November 2020. The anti-Iran organization has long been recognized as a terror group by much of the international community. However, in June 2008, the United Kingdom crossed the group off its terror list. The move was followed by the European Union in 2009 and the United States in 2012. Canada followed in the footsteps of the Western countries in delisting MKO as a terror group in December 2012 without offering any reason for the decision.
Some of them have their hands stained with blood. Some of them have battlefield experience. Some of them have some formal training by Mukhabarat, the special secret police of Saddam Hussein. So they are not just two people trying to go to Europe to make a living. They are a danger. Criminals need to go to prison, not to roam in the streets of European cities. Absolutely. This is my idea.
Since removing their decade-long ban on the MKO, the Western nations, especially the United States, have used the group as a tool to pressure Iran. But the latest revelations about the terror organization can serve as a wake-up call for its Western supporters that the threats they have been brewing against Iran will backfire on them.
A group of Nigerian Muslims have taken to the streets of the capital Abuja to denounce Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen and its continued blockade of the country. And that's it with international news. Stay tuned.
You. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
All those trillions of dollars consumed in wasteful wars have helped foster a creeping pessimism in Americans, a pessimism spawned by corporate elites increasingly consumed by greed, says William Astore, writer, in an article published under the heading, 60 years of war-making may yet result in the destruction of U.S. democracy. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. America has waged 5 major wars, winning one decisively, then throwing that victory away while losing the other 4 disastrously. Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq, as well as the so-called War on Terror, were the losses, of course. The Cold War being the solitary win that must now be counted as a loss because its promise was so quickly discarded. America's war in Vietnam was waged through the Cold War in the context of what was then known as the domino theory and the idea of containing communism. Iraq and Afghanistan were part of the so-called War on Terror, a post-Cold War event in which radical terrorism became the substitute for communism. Even so, those wars should be treated as a single strand of history, a 60-year war, if you will, for one reason alone, the explanatory power of such a concept. Several things define America's disastrous 60-year war. This would include profligacy and ferocity in the use of weaponry against peoples who could not respond in kind, enormous profiteering by the military-industrial complex, incessant lying by the U.S. government, the evidence in the Pentagon Papers for Vietnam, the missing WMD for the invasion of Iraq, and the recent Afghan war papers, accountability-free defeats, with prominent government or military officials essentially never held responsible, and the consistent practice of a militarized people that provided jobs and wealth to a relative few at the expense of a great many. In sum, America's 60-year war has featured conspicuous destruction globally, even as wartime production in the U.S. failed to better the lives of the working and middle classes as a whole. Let's take a closer look. Militarily speaking, throwing almost everything the U.S. military had, including nuclear arms, at opponents who had next to nothing should be considered the defining feature of the VLW. During those 6 decades of war making, the U.S. military raged with white-hot anger against enemies who refused to submit to its ever more powerful, technologically advanced, and destructive toys. When it comes to old service, the Air Force of Vietnam became a proving ground for the notion that air power using megatons of bombs could win a war. Just about every aircraft in the inventory then was thrown at America's alleged enemies, including bombers built for strategic nuclear attacks like B-52 Stratofortress. The result, of course, was staggeringly widespread devastation and loss of life at considerable cost to economic fairness and social equity in this country, not to mention the U.S. humanity. Still, the companies producing all the bombs, defoliants, sensors, airplanes, and other killer products did well indeed in those years. In terms of sheer bomb tonnage and the like, America's wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were more restrained, mainly thanks to the post-Vietnam development of so-called smart weapons. Nonetheless, the sort of destruction that rained down on Southeast Asia was largely repeated in the so-called War on Terror. Similarly, targeting lightly armed guerrilla groups and helpless civilian populations. And once again, expensive strategic bombers like the V-1 developed at a staggering cost to penetrate sophisticated Soviet air defenses in a nuclear war were dispatched against bands of guerrillas operating in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. What kind of prosperity are we talking about? The Vietnam War cycled through an estimated $1 trillion in American wealth. The Afghan and Iraq wars possibly more than $8 trillion when all the bills come due from the so-called War on Terror. Yet, despite such costly defeats, or perhaps because of them, Pentagon spending is expected to exceed $7.3 trillion over the next decade. Never in the field of human conflict has so much money been gobbled up by so few at the expense of so many. Throughout those 60 years of VLW, the military-industrial complex has conspicuously consumed trillions of taxpayer dollars while the U.S. military has rained destruction around the globe. Worse yet, those wars were generally waged with a strong bipartisan support in Congress and at least not actively resisted by a significant silent majority of Americans. In the process, they have given rise to the new forms of authoritarianism and militarism, the very opposite of representative democracy. Paradoxically, even as the world's greatest military lost those wars, its influence continued to grow in this country, except for a brief dip in the aftermath of Vietnam. It's as if a gambler had gone on a 60-year losing binge, only to find himself applauded as a winner. Constant war-making and militarism created certain kinds of high-paying jobs, though not frequently as many as peaceful economic endeavors would have. Wars and constant preparations for the same also drove deficit spending since few in Congress wanted to pay for them via tax hikes. As a result, in all those years, as bombs and missiles rained down, wealth continued to flow up to ever more gigantic corporations like Boeing, Raytheon, and Lockheed Martin, places all too ready to hire retired generals to fill their boards. And here's another reality. Very little of that wealth ever actually trickled down to workers unless they happened to be employed by those weapons makers, which, to steal the names of two of this country's Hellfire missile armed drones, have become this society's predators and reapers. If a pithy slogan were needed here, you might call these the Build Back Better by bombing years, which of course moves Americans squarely into Orwellian territory.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality. Back to
it's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers, men and women of all ages, hope you're doing well and taking care of your health during these hard times of the pandemic. Wherever you are, just stay safe. Well, we are here with a new episode of your favorite program, Back to Reality. This is Asma. Once again, I have the pleasure to be the host of this session. And here with me, I have two very dear guests, Sister Zainab and Brother Sheikh Yasser.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's a pleasure to meet you again. And Brother Sheikh Yasser, how are you?
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, sister. Alhamdulillah, we are well. A pleasure to be again with you.
Thank you. That's very pleasure to have you both. Well, Zainab, shall you please introduce yourself to us?
Okay, I am Zainab Askari, and I'm done with master's in linguistics from the University of Kashmir, and now I'm a student of Hausa right now.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. And you?
Yeah, I studied sports science at university in the UK.
That's very good.
And now I'm finishing my master's in Islamic philosophy.
That's very good. It's very good to have you both in here. Such a pleasure for me to be with you. Okay, listeners of IRB English Radio, today we have a very interesting topic for you, which is going to be the health risks of using internet. What are your ideas upon that, Zainab?
Everything has pros, cons, everything has a positive impact, everything has a negative impact. How you use it. It depends on user. Unfortunately, in today's world, where we are so much social media addictive, I think it has more adverse effects than it has more positive effects. I mean, social media has got tremendous potential to increase your knowledge. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it is giving you depression, anxiety.
You know, most of all, today we want to discuss the problems that would happen to our body using cell phones and being so much associated with internet. That's what we're talking about.
Well, I think...
Have you ever experienced any health problem using so much as the excessive using cell phone?
I personally, yes, of course. Lack of sleep.
Yes, lack of sleep.
The internet is designed in a way that it makes us addictive.
Exactly.
And once you are addicted, you use those screens. And research has proved that these screens, the computer screens or your mobile screens, these bright lights can, they block the secretion of a hormone that regulates sleep.
Exactly. Melatonin, so, I think.
Yeah, true. They block the... a secretion of this hormone, and then it affects your sleep. And once your sleep is affected, your body is affected, your health is affected. So it has a lot more than we think.
Little by little, we're prone to insomnia, perhaps.
Yeah.
Shall you please tell us about your experiences with the cell phone that caused problem for your health?
I don't say I had any problems with the cell phone. Besides
maybe, are you sure? Headaches? I don't know, no, neck aches?
Neck ache is, well, maybe cell phone being thrown at me, maybe it's a health danger. My sister said, like, maybe the sleep one, but I personally have not, obviously, there hasn't been anything proven for me in terms of the body.
Maybe you don't use it so much.
Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, but I have one more disorder that is maybe the doctors call it problematic internet use.
Yes.
Like while I'm cooking, I have this phobia to check my phone, who is messaging, who is updating, who is doing what. I have this, I don't know, curiosity to go to my phone and check it frequently.
And if I do not respond now, related to using cell phones,
who updated what? If I do not respond right now, maybe something will happen. Maybe I'll miss out. I have like I think I have personally felt this phobia of FOMO, failing out to missing out something. You won't get connected to your, maybe something interesting. My cousins
something
are posting.
Something is missing.
Yeah, we have a family group.
Yes,
on these internet sites, and then you always think maybe you will miss something important, maybe they are sending something, maybe I'm missing a good connection. And who is posting what? And this doctors have called as problematic internet use. They say that if you are doing that with any of your social media accounts, I don't do that with any, like all the apps, but I do that with one particular app that I use the most. However, doctors have said that you need to recommend a doctor if you're doing that.
Exactly. Every now and then we have to stop and we have to rest our head, our shoulders, our neck in order not to get serious problems with our body.
Yeah, and I always have this finger ache because of typing, because of replying.
So many syndromes I think it causes
to
our
like
hand.
If we start listing, I then think that we will we'll complete those.
Yes, many problems.
First of all, personally, I don't have any social media accounts. I don't have.
So that's why you're not having any problem.
Like, I don't any of these applications or these...
What about computers? Don't you use
I use a computer, but mainly for research purposes and stuff. So
again, writing would cause so many problems.
Writing, no. I maybe for instance, university and stuff, I've been using a laptop or a computer because, like I said, I'd really use my mobile. I use it mainly for messaging family and stuff, but not like continuously. My mobile is mainly in my pocket or in the drawer.
That's very good. How do you control that then? The urge of using cell phone.
Like I said, I don't have many of these social media apps and stuff. So if I want to find the news, I'll just maybe look at the news for an hour on my phone or less than an hour, half an hour, and then I'll put my phone away.
That's very good.
I think he's not suffering from the syndrome that I said FOMO is a fear of missing out.
I have nothing to miss out. I'm nowhere to miss out.
That's very good.
So, like the people who message you are merely friends, or if there's a meeting or something, I'll know about it a couple of days beforehand. So there's nothing to actually, you know, look, fear of missing out of something. If there's something important, I know I will find out somehow. Someone will phone me, or I'll meet somebody who will tell me.
So you're still not addicted?
No, alhamdulillah. I wouldn't say I'm addicted.
So the two of us are addicted, and one
you are
not
unfortunately
addicted.
But I feel so lucky that I don't have many other apps. Yeah. I feel so lucky because I see people who have many other apps are wasting their time. They're literally wasting their time. And we have this verse, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wal Asr. Innal insana lafi khusr.
Exactly. That's the whole story.
Yeah.
We're losing everything without even noticing it.
Without even noticing it. We are losing our life without even taking any benefit from it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, whenever, the moment I did contemplation in this surah, I was just thinking about these mobile users.
Exactly.
How much time they spend.
We devote so much of our time on that.
Yeah. Like the brother said that he's not using that. It is in some way, I won't say a completely good thing or a best way out, because he's a researcher and it could have helped him to do more and more research. So it has a pros as well. It could have even helped him. But at the same time, if you feel like I cannot control myself from this addiction, it's better for you not to use. You should have a particular time that I will be using.
Prioritizing our plan.
Yeah.
That's it. We have to put some special time for social media, cell phone or computers and so on in order not to get serious problems.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Now, brother, it's very interesting. You said that you're not using your phone a lot. Where do you bring your news if you are going to get any information?
I watch the TV, will show me the news.
And it's enough?
My wife will tell me the news.
She's going to tell you the gist of everything.
Because she's on all these social media things. So I get it from that side. So I don't need to join any of these applications. Because
She's doing
the job
for
me. So I don't need to.
She's mostly asking you, what are your personal experiences you're not using? What do you think about others who are using so much internet?
You put like... hit the nail on the head, especially when it comes to time. You use it in such a way that you're actually not aware of the time that you are wasting.
Exactly.
That's one point. But it has a deeper psychological and a spiritual harm. The psychological harm, obviously, is the one you mentioned. One of them is that you're always constantly trying to update yourself and you feel, okay, I don't know this. Like me, if I don't know something and someone tells me, you don't know.
Fear of missing out.
I didn't know about it. Fine, you told me one of those things, right? Not something that's going to... But someone, you didn't know. You know, I should have known. You know, they feel down about it.
Yeah, doctors have used a term, fear of missing out, for this problem.
So that's the thing, right? If you don't...
The story is not just about missing. Children nowadays are using so much of cell phone because they have to. We are going through a phase when we are using the online studying. So that would cause some serious health problem for them as well. So it's not just about missing. Sometimes you have to use it for a long time.
It's not about just missing, but your use, it should be planned. It should be organized. It should be programmed.
Sometimes
it should not be like problematic internet use. Like while you're cooking, you want to check who messaged me, who did not message me.
That technically, I think it's very true to say that there is no single one in this world who has not been suffering from backache, headache, neckache,
body postures.
You mentioned children. Like when they use a mobile, the kid does this.
Exactly.
Right? So
the whole neck goes
down. So whenever I see my children using it, I make sure I push them back so their back is straight, leaning against the sofa, or they're lying down. The child, so my son will lie down,
that would have some serious effect.
Not up like this, down. So the mobile's on the floor, it's like you're reading a book.
Yes.
So they're on their chest, on their stomach. So that way it doesn't hurt
their neck.
He's
trying to say that he corrects their body.
So that's one of the things, like if you talk about children, especially at this time, as you rightly, correctly mentioned, the necessity of using either tablets, mobiles, laptops, cell phones for a children or a child to learn is a necessity
and
at this moment in time.
Since you're not called a user of cell phones, what are the benefits of social media and internet in your view?
You might even argue if this is a benefit or not.
Mm-hmm.
The ability for somebody to quickly get information.
Exactly.
Is that a benefit? Is that a benefit or not? One, the amount of information. Two,
too much.
So one is too much information. Two, the amount of time it takes you to get the information. Mm-hmm. Three, the audience that information reaches.
Exactly.
Researchers found that too much information causes anxiety.
Exactly.
Depression is one of the most common things.
An important issue you pointed out, depression also. As a result of that excessive information and anxiety, I guess.
Yeah, because not only that. Mm-hmm. See, we have social media platforms today, and I would like to post. I would like to post a story, post a status, and then go to the wheel, see how many views.
Very active.
Yeah. Now, when you see the posts of other people, mm-hmm. you start comparing your life. And when you start comparing your life with others, you see they are happy. Because people do not post sad things. Even
exactly.
if I post something.
They show a beautiful picture of their life.
They show the best part of their
Everything
life.
Everything is masked.
Everything. Yeah. Exactly. Mm. Nobody knows what is behind the scene.
Exactly.
What's going on behind the scene.
Mm-hmm.
So when people are basically, checking the posts of others, seeing others happy, they don't go to this point that people have this habit of only
posting
good
things.
They feel
the lack of things.
They start comparing their lives with mm-hmm. their lives. They say, see how happy they are and how depressed I am in my life.
That is
And
very
when there
true.
Is this comparison, there's depression. It pinches me.
There's a force. You feel like there's a force.
It kind of gives
you
a form.
To be involved.
Add your bio. Add
yes.
your favorite. Add your.
Thank
maybe my
you,
husband
sister.
Never will ask. My husband will never ask me what is your favorite color. But but when I use this Facebook or any other platform, it asks me who is your cousin, who is your brother, who is your this, what is your favorite color, which school you went to, which music you like, which sports you like. Maybe
and the story
we
goes
as partners
on.
Never
yes.
asked each other, and we were not even interested in these things,
mm-hmm.
but. In that platform, when you fill up those forms, those informations, and edit your profile, add to your profile, edit your profile, give so much information about yourself, you come to know about a lot of things
exactly.
about your partner maybe you don't like. Or for example, there's a celebrity your partner is following and you don't like it.
Well, thank you, Sister Zainab and Brother Yasser. Thank you very much. We talked about the pros and cons of using so much of internet and social media, cell phones, which have been an integral part of our lives recently. We talked about the special problems, serious problems they might cause to our body and health. Also, I forgot a point to mention. So much of accidents happen through using these cell phones. So we have to take a very special care of the plannings. We have to prioritize our plan in order to use cell phone in a way that is not going to cause us any problem. And also, we could use some sports that would rest our body for some minutes after using too much of cell phones or internet. That's the way of controlling everything in order not to cause us any problems. Again, thanks for being with us. Until next time with Back to Reality, I bid you farewell. May Allah bless you with health and happiness.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again
we are with you what about you IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Biden is crushing the Afghan economy by seizing $3.5 billion of its people's money and diverting the other $3.5 billion for a trust fund to benefit the Afghan people. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Austin Allman, Ryder. This article is published under the heading Biden's Decision on Frozen Afghanistan Money is Tantamount to Mass Murder. Stay tuned for more. After making the initial decision last summer to withdraw U.S. forces from Afghanistan, the Biden administration announced recently that it intends to split the Afghan Central Bank's assets, which are held in the possession of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, between the families of 9/11 victims and unspecified efforts for the benefit of the Afghan people. The decision puts Biden on track to cause more death and destruction in Afghanistan than was caused by the 20 years of war that he ended. For months, the administration has been debating how the future of economic relations with the Taliban-controlled Afghanistan will look like. The assets, which were initially frozen when the Taliban seized control of the country in August, are essential for the liquidity and basic functionality of the economy. With the administration's lack of firm commitment to return the assets to the central bank, which American economists who helped design and still help to run say is still independent from the Taliban, the Afghan people will be reliant on humanitarian aid for the foreseeable future. Already, reports say aid is not enough to prevent the precipitous decline in living conditions the Afghan people are facing. The problem is one of the basic economics. Seizing the central bank funds has brought economic activity to a standstill. People have lost access to money held in banks. Government workers and teachers are going without paychecks. Importers have no access to capital to front the imports. Exporters similarly can't access capital to keep their businesses operating. The currency, the Afghani, has collapsed in value, and inflation is much steeper in Afghanistan than the rest of the world as a result. A White House spokesperson said the administration would create a trust fund to benefit the Afghan people in a variety of ways. In the last few months, as House Democrats squabbled over the wording of letters and senators balked at questions about America's responsibility for the crisis, the situation on the ground in Afghanistan has rapidly devolved. Multiple international organizations have warned that these conditions have pushed nearly 10 million Afghans to the brink of starvation. To survive, people are burning their furniture and other possessions to stay warm or selling them for good. While those 20 years of war, an irregularly long drought, and an especially severe winter have set the stage for the crisis, the proximate cause of the Afghan people's suffering is the seizure of Afghan assets, coupled with sanctions imposed by the United States regime. Members of Congress have been slow in coming to grips with the effects of the Biden administration's policy in the region. In December, Representatives Pramila Jayapal, Cha Garcia, and Sarah Jacobs led over 40 of their colleagues in a letter to the administration that stressed the need for conscientiously but urgently modifying current U.S. policy regarding the freeze of Afghanistan's foreign reserves and ongoing sanctions. Last week, Jayapal, the leader of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, sponsored an amendment to the America Competes Act on the sanctions. While it did not call for an end to the U.S. sanctions regime, it would have set up the groundwork for Congress to formally study the disastrous effects of economic policies. While House Democrats could have muscled the amendment through their own votes, 44 of them joined every House Republican to block its passage. The Intercept contacted each of those 44 Democrats, and not one of them would provide an on-record explanation for why they opposed studying the devastation Afghans are facing as a result of U.S. policies. With the amendment's failure, legislative action to address the crisis appears stalled for the time being, though Jayapal expressed optimism that the vote could be a precursor to an easing of U.S. restrictions. In an interview with The Intercept recently, she said the caucus felt it was a victory to win the vast majority of Democrats in a vote that, for the first time, really took on the humanitarian effects of these sanctions. Her office did not immediately respond to a request for comment on the Biden administration announcement. A senior Democratic foreign policy aide who was granted anonymity to openly share his thoughts on the Biden administration's action said the policy effectively amounts to mass murder. According to the aide, Biden has had warnings from the UN Secretary General, the International Rescue Committee, and the Red Cross, with a unanimous consensus that the liquidity of the central bank is of paramount importance and no amount of aid can compensate for the destruction of Afghanistan's financial system and the whole macroeconomy. Mark Wisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, agreed with the characterizations of Biden's decision as mass starvation. "Most people don't understand the economics of Biden's devastating decision," he told The Intercept. "If a country doesn't have reserves and it doesn't have a functioning central bank, then there is no amount of aid that's going to come anywhere close to making up for that." Recently, after months of insistence from human rights activists and international non-governmental organizations, Congress finally began to debate the United States' role in the rapidly escalating humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. In a long overdue hearing in the Senate Foreign Affairs Subcommittee that governs the West Asia, Subcommittee Chair Chris Murphy acknowledged that humanitarian aid alone would not be enough to prevent the rapidly approaching death of thousands of Afghans. Murphy did not directly call for a shift in U.S. policy during the hearing, but he said in an interview with The Intercept that the administration will need to ease sanctions and unfreeze some Afghan assets to mitigate the crisis. I believe that it's time for us to release the money, he said. Though he reiterated concerns over whether the Afghan Central Bank can remain truly independent for long under Taliban rule. The only other senator to publicly call for these actions is Senator Bernie Sanders, who tweeted his position on the matter last month. Neither senator's office responded immediately to a request for comment on Biden's decision. Other senators have mostly dismissed questions about America's complicity in a potential Afghan genocide. In interviews with Intercept over the last week, several typically outspoken liberal senators have demurred or rejected the premise of questions about U.S. sanctions regime. Senator Tammy Duckworth, a veteran of America's war in Iraq, denied hearing about the many reports indicating that humanitarian assistance alone will prove insufficient in aiding Afghans. Senator Tammy Baldwin pointed to the Taliban's prior refusal to allow women and girls to attend school and work to justify Biden's policies, but said she would further study reports confirming that since assuming power in August, the Taliban has continued to allow women to maintain a role in public life. And vocal progressive Senator Mazie Hurno responded to a question about the devastation wrought by sanctions and frozen assets with a question of her own. We're still talking about Afghanistan? In the subcommittee hearing this week, International Rescue Committee President and CEO David Miliband and International Crisis Group consultant Graeme Smith both gave full-throated condemnations of the international community's financial policies in Afghanistan. Together, the two dispelled the arguments that humanitarian aid could compensate for normalizing economic relations with Afghanistan and rebutted those who point to the cruelties of the groups to justify. Together, the two dispelled the arguments that humanitarian aid could compensate for normalizing economic relations with Afghanistan and rebutted to those who point to the cruelties of the Taliban to justify the cruelties inflicted by the Western countries.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.